Shalom. Thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery through the book of Deuteronomy.
Shalom and welcome back to our Bible study in the book of Deuteronomy. Today we are looking at chapter 21 and we're continuing from our last episode. And this is a really interesting section. It has to do with how you treat disobedient kids. By the way, I should qualify, parents, don't do this to your children. All right. So, but anyway, it says, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, I mean, how many of us have experienced that, isn't it? As parents, yes, they'll all be saying amen. So, who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, you know, I can already hear all the chorus of all the parents saying, there, you see this one, right? Who, when they have chastened him, you know, after they have punished him, will still not listen. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city. Now, in the past episodes, I already mentioned that the gate of city is where you do business, right? Basically, that's where all the judges, the elders of the city sit, and you will bring them to the elders of the city. Okay, and what will happen? This son of ours, you're just going to make a complaint, right, to the elders. This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Okay, kids, don't eat too much, okay? So, in other words, he's lazy. He doesn't want to work, right? He's just sitting around, whiling his life away. And we all can probably think of some people like that. So, all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. I don't recommend this in our culture right now. You shall put away the evil from among you, because this is a very serious problem. To be a drunkard, to be a useless person who particularly disobey the parents. So in this Old Testament time, honoring parents is very, very, very important. Deuteronomy chapter 5, 16 is one of the Ten Commandments, right? You shall honor your father and your mother. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 3, again, it repeats itself all over the place. In that culture, and really in our culture as well, it's very important to honor your parents. But the shocking thing is that the punishment for someone not honoring the parents is actually death by stoning. Now, of course, throughout the Bible, we do not have any instance of this actually happening. Why? I guess most of the time they'll change their mind before they get stoned, right? Okay, don't kill me. I'll get up and I'll work in Harvest Field or whatever the case may be, all right? Okay, so now we get to this other section, which is also very interesting. If a man commits a sin deserving death, okay, he's put to death and you hang him on a tree. Okay, get this, all right? A man has committed some sin. Now, it is not exactly clear in this verse alone what kind of sin it is. But usually, it is some kind of blasphemy or idolatry or some sort of sin that, and that's really what the, you know, rabbinic writings tell us, right? So you hang him on a tree, I guess to make an example of him. His body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, and you, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Then there's sort of like this apostrophe, for he who hang is accursed of God. Now this verse, of course, has some sort of relevance to many of us. When you read this, you kind of think about the crucifixion of Jesus, right? Obviously. So what exactly, the logic of these verses are not immediately obvious, right? First of all, okay, we understand you want to make an example of some people, right? But apparently, if you just read it, it would seem that if you leave him hanging on the tree overnight, what will happen? What do you mean by the land will get defiled? Well, okay, when they say land, normally when you say the land of a promise, right? Ha-eretz, that's the word eretz. Eretz is the Hebrew word for land. But here, although it's translated land, it's actually not. It's actually the word adama, which means earth, the ground. So when we say the land of Singapore, I won't say the ground of Singapore. When I say ground, I mean like right here, right? So there's a possibility that this is not talking about that the whole country will get polluted just because you hang up one guy, right? And what's the boundary of the country anyway? And so it could be that it's talking about, okay, you will pollute because, you know, dead bodies, right? Dead bodies attract disease and all that kind of thing. So you will pollute the ground, that area around that become, it becomes infectious or, you know, prone to disease or whatever the case may be. So there is a possibility that that could be the sense, right? That leaving a person, now that would make a little bit more sense. But then it gets a bit more complicated, right? So This whole idea of he who is hanged is cursed of God. Now, in the new, let's see, in the New American Standard Bible, it's actually placed in brackets. Do you have that? Anyone using NAS? Right? It's actually put in brackets there. Now, of course, in the Hebrew, there's no bracket, right? In the New King James Version, this comes after what is a semicolon at the end of the verse, right? At the end of the verse. But actually, that's not in the Hebrew, it's not at the end of the verse. In the Hebrew, it's in the middle, you know. Ki kalala Elohim talui. Okay, so it's in the middle for cursed. Or, okay, here's a very tricky translation. This translation can mean a lot of things, right? In this case, the obvious meaning is for cursed of God is the hanged one or the hanged person, right? Why is a person who is hanged cursed of God? Does it make any sense, you know? You hang someone up, how does that incur a curse? This part is really puzzling, right? So, and it's not just puzzling to us, it's actually quite puzzling to all the people in the past. It's just translation of this, is some the Targum, which is the Syriac translation, actually says that the hanged person is an affront to God, right? Meaning that this person, he has sinned, that's why he's hung up. And because he has sinned, he's an affront to God. But he's dead already, right? Remember, this guy is already dead. But maybe that sin hanging him up is a reminder to God that here's someone who's sinned and God doesn't want to see him, you know, or something like that. You know, that's just the sense of affront. Now, I was looking at this and it's very interesting because of these multiple possible translations, right? Now, of course, by the time you get to Galatians chapter 3, verse 13, you only accept one translation. Although, you still don't know why. Why is a person who's hung on a tree cursed of God? So, you can have at least five translations. One is hanging up a person, as I mentioned from the Targums, right? Hanging up a person is an affront to God. It's offensive to God. It can mean like that. Two, a person who's cursed, right? There's a person who's punished. When you say cursed, in this case, it means punished. A person who's punished is hanged up. That's saying nothing. It's just like stating the obvious. Three, a person who is cursed of God is hanged up. In other words, the person whom God punishes is hanged up. Or it could mean, number four, a person who is hanged up is cursed by God. Now, this part is the one that tends to go down in our Galatians. See, the act of hanging up a person incurs some sort of curse on it. That's one of multiple possible translations, right? And then there are some people who also say the word God here, by the way, is not Yehovah, right? It's the word Elohim. That's why you see it's capital G, but the O-D is not all capital L-O-R-D, right? So in other words, it's the word Elohim. And in some cases, Elohim is translated as judges. There are a couple of places in the Bible where Elohim is translated as judges also. So some people say, no, this is not talking about God. It's talking about the judges. Okay, in either case, Paul is using this particular verse to make a particular argument, right? So he's saying that Jesus became a curse kind of on our behalf. But this itself is a bit problematic, right? Because first of all, this curse, Jesus was punished, right? You could say to take our place on the cross, that would be the penal substitutionary model, right? Substitute us. But then to add to it, to say Jesus became a curse. I think the way I would see is that to say that Jesus became a curse on our behalf would be equal to saying God punished Jesus on our behalf. That's kind of what I would say, right? And that seems to me the easiest way to understand this whole thing. Jesus was punished by God on our behalf. I guess that will be what Galatians chapter 3 verse 13 says. Because you have other cases, like remember how did Absalom die? He was running around, you know, fighting, and then he got caught hanging in a tree, right? Yeah. So he was not dead. He was just hanging in a tree. So first of all, hanging in a tree, is that a curse? I mean, some of us climb around, right? Monkeying around, climb trees. Just hanging from a tree doesn't automatically make you a curse, like, you understand? Okay, just hanging a tree doesn't automatically bring God's punishment. But in this case of Absalom, right, he was hanging around and then some people came upon him. What did they do? Joab took three spears, right, through him. Now he's dead. Okay, he was hanging on tree first, and then he dies. I guess you could say he was kind of speared, right, or crucified that way. So, now does he automatically become a curse? Now, he was left hanging there for a little while, right? So, does he automatically become... See, these are the sort of things that sometimes we have to ask. Because how is hanging connected to cursing, right, or punishment? And that is not very clear. I have to say it's not very clear, right? But although we know what Paul is making of it, but it's not very clear to us exactly what is the problem with hanging. What point if you don't hang the person? Is that a curse, right? So, something interesting. Okay, so we kind of move on a little bit. Okay, chapter 22. You know what you like to say, finders keepers, right? Right. When we were growing up, you know, in school, you pick up a sharpener and say, oh, finders keepers, you know. Well, it says here in chapter 22, right? You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray, wandering around, and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother. Okay, you have to return this thing. Okay, that's those people that it's not my problem. Right? Sometimes, so it's one is you cannot take it for yourself. Neither can you ignore it. So you see the thing lost somewhere, it becomes your responsibility. This part of the whole idea of collective responsibility that we started talking about in our previous episode, that there is a mutual response. It's not just, look, it's none of my business. It is entirely your business because, you know, that was the question that Cain asked, am I my brother's keeper? That was a rhetorical question. The answer is actually yes. Okay, in the biblical, it's the historical context of the Bible, yes, we are supposed. Now, whether this is cultural or whether this is principle, I think it has to do with the principle. Because love your neighbor as yourself. This is just part of how you will translate that simple command into practical laws. And the practical law is you see your brother's ox. Okay, today, you see your brother's, you know, Honda rolling down the road by your side, you wouldn't say, ah, take pictures, send the storm. No, you are supposed to stop the car and return the car back. You're supposed to do that because we don't have ox or sheep anymore, right? So you may have to think how that will apply to us. Okay, so you do the same. By the way, if your brother is not near you or you do not know who's, okay, you say, but I do not know whose ox this is. There's no branding on it. I don't recognize him, okay? So it shall be that it remain with you until your brother seeks it. So you're holding this ox, which actually means you have to feed the ox also. Lah. You won't be like, I'm just holding it, but look, you're not coming, I'm not feeding it. By the time come, sorry, your ox died. Lah. Okay, so there again, there's this extended responsibility. You're not just this dispassionate, I don't watch up kind of attitude about other people. You actually have to treat that person's animal like your own. And you ask yourself, wow, that's really useful because it teaches us what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. Leviticus 19:18, right? So, ve'ahavta lareka kamoka. So, love your neighbor as yourself. Yeah, that's right. So, very interesting, this law. And then it goes on some more. You shall do the same to his donkey, right? And so shall you do with his garment, with any lost thing which your brother he has lost and has found, you shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself, okay? You shall not siam, basically is what the whole idea is. Because, you know, some people say, look, I don't want to look after his animal. What, I have to come up with my own hay to feed his animal? Pretend I didn't see, right? Or pretend I didn't know. You shall not do that. And, you know, this is a law. This is, I guess you could call this a case law. It's cultural, contextual law, right? But it is an expression of the principle, the constitutional law of the kingdom. Okay, it goes on lots of donkey laws here, right? Verse 4, it says, you shall not see his donkey fallen along the side of the road and hide yourself. You are supposed to help them again. Some people here today will pretend it's not my problem, right? Yeah, everyone mind your own business, right? Not my problem, not my cow, not my horse. In our case, if you are driving along the road and you see somebody's tire breakdown, car breakdown, you know, and we're like, not my problem, I've got to go work, right? Now, if you want to be really strict about this principle, it becomes necessary for us to actually stop and help people. That's like, wow. You want practical application? There you go, okay? You see me on the roadside, you know, car broken down, please stop, okay? Help. Titus, read for us verse 5.
Verse 5. A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God.
Whoa, okay, serious stuff, okay? Serious stuff. I don't want to ask how many women are wearing pants here, but this is a serious stuff. Because you know what? It is an abomination. Okay, I think we got to... we have to look at this for a little bit, okay? Because otherwise, we will not go home in peace, right? So literally, it says, you shall not make to be caligaver, a man on a woman. So you shall not put this garment, a kind of garment of a man or a woman. You shall not wear a man, right? You shall not wear on man a woman's simlat, a woman's garment also. So what exactly is this about? You know, I mean, cross-dressing, yes, definitely cross-dressing, right? But obviously cross-dressing means fashion. Fashion is a bit cultural, isn't it, right? What is a woman's dressing? That is obviously something very cultural. I mean, when they were in the Garden of Eden, they wore the same thing, what? Fig leaves, right? So, or the animal dressing. That wasn't a fashion as such. So you have to kind of think a bit broadly. So what does this particular... remember, these are not constitutional laws, right? These are laws that are applied to context situations. So what is the purpose of this law? What is the target of this law, right? And was it... Why do you even need this law? Was it a case that there were a lot of people going around wearing the wrong things? Okay, now... This is really interesting, but of course, this particular law is made even more important for us to look at because it says this is a to'eva to Yehovah. In other words, to'eva is an abomination. This is abhorrent. So what is it about this whole thing that's abhorrent to Yehovah? Okay, so rabbinic sources have, you know, they struggle with this for a long time. Some rabbinic sources, right, say that this is a prayer shawl. Okay, this is talking about a prayer shawl. And others will say that, no, this garment is actually garments of war. In other words, women should not go to war. Okay, now let me just say, I don't think these are very strong arguments, right? For example, this one, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, these are all very ancient rabbis. They're trying to find something to make sense out of this thing. So they say, you know, this is about women going to war. Women should not go to war, okay? Rashi is another, I think, 12th century maybe. I could be wrong on that. Rabbi says a woman should not dress up as a man to go out with them. Why? Because it might lead to impropriety. Because people don't know that you're a woman. They can't recognize that you're a woman. They might just grab you with a hug and they, it's a tabo, right? So it's a problem here, right? So, you know, you might accidentally engage a member of the opposite sex in an inappropriate way. So the Rashis, no, you can see they're all trying. They're all trying to come up with some reason for why this is the case, right? So they say it is to prevent adultery. Now, I can't imagine any situation where a man would dress up as a woman to go out with woman. That is like, that is not normal, right? It's certainly not normal in that context, and even in today's context, although today there are a lot more strange people, but you know, it's still not normal even in today's context. But really, Rashi's argument is that it might result in wrongful association. But think about it, is wrongful association an abomination to God? When even an adultery is not considered abomination to God. It is wrong, but it's not escalated to this level. So, you know, these explanations, they're not very convincing for me, right? So I'm not totally sold on it. I think, what are the things that are an abomination to God? Usually, these are things relating to idolatry, right? Pagan practices and such. And so, there's a possibility that this was something that they did. For example, we know that homosexual practices was done in pagan Canaanite practices. Actually, I have a document on that. And they actually give us examples of how they would go to these temples and the men would sleep with the men. And then, out of that ritual, get some sort of fortune telling, for example, right? And so that became an abomination to the Lord. And that's one reason why you see in Leviticus chapter 18, it talks about man laying down with a man as with a woman, right? As an abomination to the Lord. But that is not the only reason it's wrong, because, you know, then again, you also find in Deuteronomy chapter 20, that whole listing, adultery, bestiality, incest. So this is also wrong because it's classed with all these unnatural behaviors and unintended behaviors. But certainly one of the reasons why something is an abomination. And in those cases, abominations relate to this, I guess, idolatry. So I would venture a guess. I think this has to do with some kind of religious practice. Because I don't think people normally go around like that, right? And what about disguise? Right? Sometimes there's people presumably go out disguised as some people to escape. So I would think that this particular thing is not so much about fashion, but it's about, I guess it's about idolatry, pagan worship, right? So that would seem how I would look at it. Truthfully, it's not so clear. That's why so many people and scholars and rabbis and people have debated over this issue for a very long time. But it's very interesting, right? Verse 6 and 7, we kind of move on to some easier stuff, right? Bird's nest. Okay, bird's nest, right? If a bird's nest happened to be before you along the way in a tree, with the young ones and eggs. So you're walking along the road and you see, wow, there's a bird's nest, right? And there's eggs and there are the young ones there and the mother is there, right? You shall not take the mother with the young, but you will let the mother go. You take the young for yourself. You can eat the young, you can eat the eggs, but you got to let the mother go because the mother laid eggs, right? So, wow, this is a strange law. I mean, look. I mean, I can sort of understand the logic of it, right? I mean, survivalist, yeah. But why is this even a law, right? Well, clearly, because this was something that was part of the life of the people. Again, when you read laws, it's not just all about religious stuff. This is about how society functions. And this is just some of this very interesting, right? You have another one that, you know, verse 8, if you build a house, right, you must build a parapet. What's a parapet? Means like a fence so that people climb. Those days, the houses had flat tops. So it's very easy to run up to the top, right? Your kids run up to the top. But then, you know, if you don't have a fence at the top, your kids will run out and play and then fall down and they will die. Now, by the way, what's interesting is that you also find similar kind of, contextual laws, right? I don't know what you call it. I need to think of a better name to call it. I've been calling case law. It's not really case law, but these are contextual guidelines, right? Like your building code, how to run this. And in Hammurabi's code, Hammurabi appears in the Bible as, I can't remember his name right now, Amrashel or something. Okay, he appears as one of these people, but he's very famous for having come up with laws. And these are, I'll read to you two of his code laws. He says, if a builder builds a house for someone and does not construct it properly, and the house which he built falls down and kills the owner, then that builder shall be put to death. You know, recently we read the China and all these buildings falling apart. They didn't. Builder shall be put to death because he's been negligent, right? I mean, that's Hammurabi's code, not Bible code, right? So another law says, if a builder builds a house for someone, even though he has not yet completed it, and then the walls seem to be toppling, the builder must make the wall solid from his own means. Means, you know, it's under warranty, basically, right? So you know, you see that in that ancient world, they were already creating a lot of these laws in order to organize society. Because if you don't have laws, your societies cannot function, you see. So part of what holds society together are all these agreed upon laws. So they are not necessarily moral laws in and of itself, but they are based on moral principles, right? So there are some puzzling ones like verse 9. You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed. You know, I wouldn't know the first thing about agriculture, right? But I suspect it is some sort of probably agricultural wisdom that we have no clue about. Okay, verse 10 is interesting because we kind of come across this. You shall not plow an ox and a donkey together. What does this word mean even, right? You shall not plow, harash. Okay, quite literally, you shall not yoke an ox and a donkey together. It shall not be unequally yoked. Right? That's where that verse comes from. So what is this? Why do you suppose we shouldn't yoke a donkey and ox together? What's the ox is going to work? The donkey is not going to work. The donkey just sit there and it drag along, you know, right? Kind of stubborn. And so it becomes, well, first of all, it's unfair. It's a torture for the ox to do two animals work when, you know, one of them. So that's just unfair. It's unsuitable, unequitable, right? So I think, you know, in this law, you know, Paul later on in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, takes sort of like the broad principle of the law and then repurposes it to talk about relationships. Although the real context is about fairness, right? So the fairness would be, I should not send, let's say, I have to be very careful in the examples. I should not send Sing Yan and Arthur to clean the roof, because Sing Yan will do most of the roof cleaning. Sorry, I was just kidding. No. I was talking about King Arthur, all right? Okay, for those of you who are following, you don't know this, you've got to come to Church Our Savior. You know, it's just a super interesting thing. But basically, it has to do with fairness, right? You want to put... Now, again, these are social laws. You want to get something done well, send a team of balanced people, right? And of course, then Paul later on talks about relationships. So he's saying that, you know, it's not good to have unbalanced relationships, right? Because one will drag down the other. So that's, I guess, a fair application of the principle that's going on here. Although, in its form that you find in Deuteronomy chapter 22, it's actually just a kind of social law, but there is a principle behind it, right? So you can see how Paul applies what is otherwise a kind of like a contextual. We are okay to repurpose the law. So similarly, when we read this and we understand the principles, it will not be out of place for us to think about how we could apply those principles in our own context, right? Verse 11, another one of those things that I have no clue, because we are all wearing mixed linen today, right? Such as wool and linen mixed together, it's a problem, but not sure why. And then verse 12 is just as puzzling, right? You shall make tassels on the four corners of your clothing with which you cover yourself. Now, tassels are just this like little hanging things at the corner. I don't know why. To be very honest, I have not a clue as to why that might be the case. I have heard some theories, but I'm not going to spend too much time there, right? Verse 13 is interesting because here you have a wife, right? If a man takes a wife, so you get married, and he goes into her, okay, and detests her. Now, remember, you heard this word detest before, right? Remember in the earlier time, you take one of these captives as your wife, and afterward, you don't like her, right? You take no delight in her, or you detest her. So it means you want to reject this person for whatever reason that may be, right? In this case, the reason why he detests her is most likely that he found that she was not a virgin. Most likely, okay? So how would he know that? You know, I guess I don't need to elaborate on some of these things. You can do your own research on this. But in this case, it would seem that maybe the woman presented herself as a virgin, and they go through this whole betrothal, and then they consummate the thing. And that day he discovers that, no, it's not. Now, okay, today we can argue, you know, it's debatable because, you know, you can break your hymen due to other kind of, you know, exertions and all that. Okay, so in any case, he's not happy, right? So now he rejects the woman and he charges her, verse 14, with shameful conduct. And that's what this is about. It's not just talking about, I detest her, well, I don't like her looks. No, it has to do with, I think, this whole idea of discovering that she might not have been chased before, right? So, and brings a bad name to her and says, I took this woman and when I came to her, which is euphemistic, right? To say that they had relationships, I found that she was not a virgin. Now today we would say that, you know, that's not a very thorough way of ascertaining whether a person is or is not a virgin, right? But that was the case in that city. So what you should do, the father and the mother of the young woman shall take and bring her out the evidence. That's what I have in the, is it in italics? In other words, it's not there. But basically, you take the young woman's virginity, is what it says in Hebrew. How do you take the woman's virginity and show people? How do you do that? How will you do that in the Chinese culture? In Chinese culture, what do you have? On the night of the wedding, you will lay out a white cloth under the bed, right? And if you come out air is red color, you know, then you're good, right? If you're not red color, you send back the suckling pig, right? That's sort of like, you know, with a ear broken. No, these are Chinese culture. Now, I think that's probably what's happening there. Okay? The evidence will be the blood. And now, again, we will look at this and say, you know, medically, that's not a very sound way of going about this thing, you see? Because in some cases, too bad for the person, you know? But in any case, that's how they did it. And now he has charged her with shameful conduct. So if there is a proof that the husband was just trying to, you know, so it's very important for the woman to keep the cloth after that, I presume, because this is the proof of her honor, you know, so to speak, her chastity. So if she has a proof, then the man well, he cannot divorce her all the days of his life. Meaning that in other cases, women can be divorced. But in this case, if you have wrongly accused her, you have spoiled her name, you are stuck with her forever, right? And on top of that, you have to pay 100 shekels of silver. But verse 20, here's the other thing. But if this thing was true, right? And the so-called evidence of virginity was not found. In other words, you can't show the cloth. Wow. Verse 21. You shall bring the woman to the door of the father's house, and the men of a city shall stone her to death. Why? Okay, on this side, the man's is 100 shekels, okay? For the woman, it's like, why? Why do you stone a woman to death? What could be the reason? Well, sort of that. Yeah, it does say that. But actually, I think what's happening is basically you have dishonored your parents. Right? Remember that the law we just saw just now. If you dishonor your parents, actually you could be punished by stoning. So this, it's not so much that this woman has done this or done that. It's the fact that she has brought dishonor to her parents. And thou shalt not, bring dishonor to your parents, right? You shall honor your parents. And the punishment is very serious. And I think the severity of it really has to do with this whole idea of honor. And you know, even today, in the Middle East and countries there, about you got this whole issue of honor killings and stuff like that. It's not too different from this kind of thing, right? Verse 30. Okay, we can jump straight to that. It says that a man shall not take his father's wife, obviously, nor uncover his father's bed. That one verse is very interesting, okay? A man shall not take his father's wife, which is incest, right? Nor uncover. Now, in Hebrew, you have a lot of these doublings. You know, you say one thing two different ways, but it really means the same thing. So to uncover the father's bed is actually to take the father's wife. It means the same thing. Now, why do I say this is interesting? Because, and by the way, you have other examples of the same law, right? Leviticus chapter 20, verse 11. It says, the man who lies with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness, which is basically what I'm saying. It's not two different things. It's the same thing, okay? To lie with the father's wife is to uncover his nakedness. Well, by the way, in the Bible, you have a number of cases like this. Genesis 35, Reuben slept with Bilhah, his father Jacob's concubine, right? He's not supposed to do that, but I mean, he might have reasons to do that because he may want to usurp the control of the family and things like that. In 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 21 to 22, Adonijah made a request of David to give Abishag the Shulamite. So this was David's concubine. Why did Adonijah want to do that? Because David was dying already, right? So whoever gets the father's concubine, it's like the designate heir to the throne. So at that point in time, you know, Solomon heard about it, and so all this big fight. But that was a kind of thing. After that, David was very angry. How can you ask this thing? This is to uncover, it's dishonoring to the father, but it's also to uncover the father's nakedness, right? In 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 21-22, Absalom, right? Absalom slept with David's concubines. Why did he do that? In front of everybody, to show that he's now king, right? But that is also to uncover the father's nakedness. Now, okay, this one we know, right? Along with a whole bunch of other forbidden sexual relationships. Now, in Genesis 9, verse 21, you have this whole problem with Ham. Okay, now let's look at Genesis 9:21. 9 verse 21, all right? Then he, meaning Noah, drank of wine and was drunk. Now, as far as we know, being drunk was not a sin back in those days anyway, right? And he became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his brother outside. Okay, what actually is going on in this whole context here, right? Now, this is kind of a bit of speculation, but I think it's interesting. We got last few minutes to something interesting. Okay, so you have this situation where Ham goes in. We don't know exactly what happens, but it has to do with uncovered nakedness of the father. We don't know exactly what happens. Now, the other two sons, when they heard of it, you know, Shem and Japheth, they came back and they kind of covered back the father's nakedness. Nothing else is mentioned. That's all it is. But when Noah woke from his wine, he kind of found out what happened. Right? Now, what did he actually find out? How do you find out if someone had looked at you? So maybe something more has happened, right? But what is interesting is that after Noah found out what Ham did, what did Noah do? He cursed who? Why didn't he curse Ham? Okay, so how many sons did Ham have? Three or four sons, right? Multiple sons. Canaan was just the youngest of them all. So why don't curse all the other sons? Why pick on Canaan? Right? So this is super interesting, right? Because in Genesis chapter 10, verse 6, you have this whole idea that the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. So four sons. Canaan is just the last one. So why pick on this guy, right? So why is Canaan now singled out? And then now you look Genesis verse 9, 18. So this is after this whole incident happened. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark, right, were Shem, Ham, Japheth. And then it adds one more line. It says, and Ham was the father of Canaan. So some people look at all this and they're saying, actually, maybe this is what happened. Actually, there was incest. And a son was born. And that son was Canaan. That is why Canaan got the curse when all the other sons didn't. And that's why here when he mentions, notice it doesn't mention all the other sons. Because when they list the sons, they normally start with the oldest, they end with the youngest, right? So in listing, Noah had all these sons. These are the sons of Noah. Ham, Shem, Japheth, right? Why do you want to add Canaan there? So that's the argument, right? The argument is that, could it be that something is going on that they cover up a little bit because it's kind of shameful matter? So could it be that? And that, if that's the case, that will explain a number of things, right? First, they will explain one, why was Canaan singled out for cursing among all the other brothers? It seems rather unfair. But if this was indeed what happened, then Canaan is actually what you call a mamzer, or an illegitimate son, or if you like, bastard, right? And the bastard will not enter into the congregation. Many laws concerning the so-called bastard later on, and that's also why they were being ejected out from the land, the wickedness. And so there is a whole school of thought. I'm not saying that this is for sure. I thought this is quite an interesting thing concerning this particular law, okay? But things that you can go back and study about. Okay, so we do see this, and of course, another place where this, some people, and again, I'm saying some people because, you know, these are controversial stuff. Some people will say that, you know, Ruth uncovered the corner of Boaz. Well, where he's, I guess when it's lying down, right? So some people actually say that this whole uncovering of that is actually euphemistic for actual something happening. So, you know, I'm just going to leave that for you to read up because it's very interesting, right? Some people say that because there's some sexual connotation to all that. But that leaves us actually with chapter 23. But we're going to continue chapter 23 in our next episode. God bless all of you. I hope this has been exciting. If you've got questions, remember to post it down in the comment section below. God bless you, and I'll see you again.
We hope you enjoyed studying the Word of God. Join us again as we continue through the book of Devarim.